All right, thank you very much, Alvaro. Thanks a lot for having me here. Thanks for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to talk to you about some recent results that we had about putting together quantum error correction with symmetries. And hopefully, I'll walk through a few applications and tell you that it's actually interesting to put these two concepts together and say something about that. So this is joint work with a bunch of people. It turned out that we were a lot of people interested in the same topics, so you know, kind of got into a nice crowd. This is joint work with Victor Albert and John Preskill at Caltech, with Patrick Hayden, Grant Salton, and Seper Nizami at Stanford, and Fernando Pastaski in Berlin. All right. So as I said, there are two concepts that normally we were used to seeing them separate, but I like to see what happens when we put them together. On one hand, we have symmetries. Symmetries, typically in quantum information, we think about a group of transformations that act on a Hilbert space, right? So we have on that side symmetries, and on the other hand, we have the notion of quantum error correction in quantum information. And there, typically, we're interested in using an error correcting code to protect fragile quantum information from disturbance by a noisy environment. And the question I would like to answer today is, what happens if we put these two concepts together? What happens if we look at a situation in which both quantum error correcting codes as well as symmetries are relevant and we require them to be compatible in a certain way? Let me start with quantum error correction. And with a crowd like this, this is probably not necessary, but let me just go through the basics just to at least set my notation. Imagine you start off with some logical states on some logical system here, say phi on some logical system L. And imagine you want to protect it against some environment. So what you do is you have some encoding map that will encode this logical information into your physical systems, after which you're going to expose these physical systems to whatever environment they're subject to, such something that will bring noise into these systems. And after that, what you want for quantum error correction is you want to be able to have a recovery map that will take the remaining physical systems. For instance, imagine that the environment just erased one of these systems, just we lost it somewhere on the way. Well, what we want is to be able to recover from the remaining systems. We want to be able to recover the original information that we had on the logical system. So if we're able to do this, then our code is an error-correcting code. And this is basically a definition of an error-correcting code. And of course, one of the big questions of in the field of quantum error correction is to find good codes, right? Depending on, of course, what noise you have, how large of the systems each of these are, and so on. So that's a huge body of research, is basically finding good codes. And there are a lot of things that are known about quantum error correction. We have a huge body of solid foundations and models and conditions and, you know, whatever we need to really study well these codes. We have, for instance, conditions that tell us when a code is error correcting. We have a lot of formalisms that allow us to construct and analyze the performance of these codes, some of which are, some people are in the audience. So we have quantum error correction is something that is pretty well understood. On the other hand, it's really important, and I don't believe I have to convince you of that, because it's widely believed that quantum error correction is one of the keys to achieving a functional universal quantum computer, right? Because we'll need to be able to fight against the disturbances of the noisy environment. And it's becoming exciting, because as technology advances, hopefully we're getting more and more within experimental reach of actually implementing fault-tolerant quantum computation within a future that's hopefully not too distant. All right, that was about quantum error correction. Now, on the other hand, I talked about symmetry. So in quantum information, when we think about symmetry, well, we typically think, for instance, imagine I have a spin, and it's pointing in one direction, right? It's pointing upwards, say. Well, there are some things that I can do to this system, which is on a physical level, right? I don't have to talk to you about quantum information to tell you that I can just rotate this spin around. It's something I can really do physically in the lab. I can even just rotate my lab frame and not even touch the spin itself if I wanted. So typically, these transformations form a group that we write formally as, you know, with a group structure. And if we ask what happens, what these physical transformations correspond to in Hilbert space, well, we all know from quantum mechanics that we have to look at unitary representations of this group. Right. And this is a powerful tool in different areas in quantum information. And one context in which it's specifically interesting is the context of reference frames. So for me, for this talk, for me, a reference frame is going to be anything that's asymmetric with respect to some symmetry. And just by virtue of being asymmetric, it's going to be potentially useful to give you information about a direction. Right? So imagine if I want to communicate to you something like a particular direction, I can imagine preparing a gyroscope and exciting it, spinning it hard and fast, and sending it to you, and that will give you a reference with which you can align, say, another system. All right. Now, what I mean by looking at quantum error correction, combining that with symmetries, I mean covariant codes. So what does that mean? So I told you, for quantum error correction, we have a logical system, and we want to encode the logical information into physical systems. Well, now I'm going to require that this code is compatible with a given symmetry. So more precisely, I mean that if you take, so you'll want a group action on the logical and the physical level, in a way that if I rotate individually each physical system according to their, the way I, to their natural physical action, well, it has to be exactly the same thing as if I had just originally rotated the logical information. So that means that the encoding has to commute with the rotation, the group action. Right? So if I rotate first and then encode, it has to be the same as if I encode first and then rotate, basically. And for this talk, I'll be mostly interested in continuous symmetries. Right? So I'll be looking at not necessarily finite groups G, but continuous groups, which will have the structure of a Lie group. And if you have the structure of a Lie group, then you have something that's very interesting, is that you know, you have generators that generate these transformations under suitable conditions. And the important thing, the very interesting thing about covariant codes and in the presence of a continuous symmetry is that this code has to conserve the physical charge associated with these rotations. So for instance, if I have rotations SO3 and I'm looking at spin, well, we know that the rotations are generated by the spin operators. So that tells me that whenever I have a code that's covariant with respect to these rotations, then necessarily it must conserve spin. It means an eigenstate of spin here must be encoded. So for instance, the spin in the z direction has to be encoded into an eigenstate on the global, a global eigenstate that's also an eigenstate, a total eigenstate of the same charge on the physical level. So basically, the code must conserve these physical quantities. So I'll just refer to these physical quantities as a charge. Right? It's just, it can be anything. It can be spin, energy, or right. Or another way of seeing this is if you look at time evolution, and the generator is, of course, a Hamiltonian, well, your covariant code has to encode an energy eigenstate into a global energy eigenstate on the physical level that has the same energy up to some constant shift. All right. So this is the setting I'll be considering during this talk. Now, why would we be interested in covariant codes? Well, I can think of at least four different applications. So the first application is if you want to do error correction of quantum reference frames. And this was studied by a recent paper by Patrick, Grant, Sepper, and Sandu. And they showed that if you want to do error correction of reference frames, well, the question is really the same as finding covariant codes. It's the same question, basically. Then you have the question of if you want to perform computation on your encoded states in a way that's fault tolerant. So if you want to do, for instance, transversal gates, well, we know that it's not possible to do universal computation transversally thanks to the Eason-Knill theorem. Well, it turns out that the Eason-Knill theorem is, you can view it as a statement about covariant codes. So there's another situation in which covariant codes are a relevant concept. And I'll go into these examples in more detail in a minute. If you're more of a physicist and you're interested more in condensed matter, for instance, well, we know that in this recent paper by Fernando Elizabeth Borac, CyanogLU, that there are natural situations in, say, 1D translational invariant systems where you can naturally find approximate quantum error correcting codes. And more generally, you might be interested in properties of condensed matter systems and their relation to quantum error correction. And this is, again, a situation where symmetries and error correction are both relevant. And finally, there's an obvious application and that's for holographic quantum gravity. So we believe that there is this holographic correspondence, for instance, the ADS-CFT correspondence, that tells you that a gravity theory in the bulk should be dual to a conformal field theory that lives on the boundary, and that the mapping that relates one to the other can be understood as an error correcting code. Now, of course, a situation like this has a lot of symmetries in it. You can think of gauge symmetries, time evolution, pick your favorite symmetry. So it's natural, again, to combine the concepts of symmetry and error correction and see what that gives us. All right, let's go through these applications one by one, and I'll give you a little more details. So imagine that Alice wants to send a reference frame to Bob, right? So imagine that the channel on the way is noisy, so she wants to do some form of error correction. So Alice will use some kind of code to encode her reference into several systems, and she'll send these systems over, and because the environment is noisy, maybe one of these systems will get lost. And then the task is that Bob is able to recover from the remaining systems the original direction that Alice wanted to send him. Now, it turns out if you stare at this picture long enough, you'll see that this is basically requiring that your code is compatible with this symmetry. Now, why is this? You can see it simply because if it's not, well, the relative orientation between Alice and Bob is encoded as a transformation that happens here in the transfer of the reference frame of these systems from Alice to Bob. So the rotation really happens on the physical level here. But the information that we're interested in is the logical information that Alice prepared and that Bob will decode. So here, if the encoding is not compatible with the symmetry, if it doesn't commute with the symmetry, then there's no way that then the reference information will be destroyed on the way. So this argument is made more precise again in this paper. So this is one situation in which you're interested in having codes that are covariant. On the other hand, you know, of course, the Eason-Knill theorem. So if you're interested in fault tolerance, you want to do, say, transversal gates for your computation on your encoded state. And Eason-Knill showed that, you know, there's no universal gate set that will allow you to do that. It will allow you to do universal computation. And if I draw this picture again, it'll make sense that basically the setup is the same as for covariant codes that I showed you before, right? You want, in the setup of the Eason-Knill theorem, you want to be able to, by performing transversal unitaries on your physical systems, you want to induce a transformation on the logical level. So basically, the Eason-Knill theorem is a case of covariant codes where your group is the full unitary group on the logical level, right? So that's another situation in which covariant codes are relevant. That's if you want to do fault-tolerant quantum computation. So, for instance, in this paper I've been referencing, it has been shown that, well, you can rephrase this in terms of covariant codes, and that this is only possible, you can only find such covariant codes for some finite groups. And that's actually only valid for finite dimensions, and this will come up later. Now, I mentioned this other application in condensed matter. So, Fernando, Burak, and Elizabeth, they showed that in several 1D translation invariant system, actually, if you pick your energy levels right, they form an approximate quantum error correcting code. And perhaps it's surprising that you can find these codes that come up that naturally in these systems. But the intuition is relatively simple. It's you have this information that is completely delocalized over many physical systems in a way that if you look locally at one of these physical systems, you basically don't know the global state, right? You don't know which, say, of two or three different energy global energy eigenstates you've encoded. So that actually is a property that tells you that your code is actually not bad in terms of error correction. And in general, it's interesting to look at error correcting properties of states in condensed matter, because we know we have several examples where error correction actually really tells you something about physical properties of the system. For instance, if you look at topological codes and anions, that we know that, you know, it relates to phases of matter and so on. So it's interesting to look at error correction to infer physical properties of condensed matter systems in general. And then finally, the last application I mentioned was holography. So we know that we have this correspondence that we can interpret as a error correcting code. And we have symmetries in the bulk, which we would like to relate to symmetries on the boundary. And so I should mention from the start that I'm far from being an expert in holography, and I'm learning a lot of things. So we're only scratching the surface here of what we could actually do in holography. So I'd be really looking forward also to see in more detail what we could actually say about this situation. But this holography application was really our main motivation for starting off this project, simply because you can think of it as, say, well, you have the CFT that evolves, that has a time evolution defined by its Hamiltonian, and you also have a well-defined time evolution in the bulk. And you can ask, well, how is it possible to have this time evolution and not violate this Eason-Kneel theorem? And well, one of our results is to interpret that in a more precise way via approximate quantum error correction. Right. And hopefully, we'd like also to relate our results to the fact that there are no global symmetries, a fact that's being outlined by Harlow and Oguri. And that, again, we don't have anything precise at the moment, but it's certainly something that has to be related to our results, because it relates to similar concepts. All right. Let me start with Eason-Kneel and what happens when you go to infinite dimensions. That's really how the story starts. So imagine that we have the same setup again, where we want to encode states using a covariant code. So if you ask, when is this possible? Well, it's possible if you have a finite group, and if you can be finite dimensional in the Hilbert space, so we know that this is possible. You can do some gates transversally on your physical systems. However, if you want to go to a continuous group, this is no longer possible. All right, so if you still have finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and you want to perform a continuous family of unitary transversally, this is not possible. Right? This was shown again in this same paper about reference frame error correction. On the other hand, in the same paper, they show that if you have a continuous group, but you're allowed to work in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, then suddenly you can circumvent this Eason-Kneel theorem. There is now a loophole that via this infinite dimensions that you can exploit to actually carry out your transversal unitaries. So this might be a little surprising. You can ask, well, how is this possible? So you'd like to understand this transition from finite dimensional impossible to infinite dimensional possible. So we'd like to quantify maybe here, how impossible is it to do it here? Maybe if we go to larger and larger dimensions, well, we'd be able to approximately perform these unitaries better and better. And when we go to the limit of infinite dimensions, we'll be able to do it in that limit infinitely well. Yes?
What kind of infinite dimension was involved in the earlier result?
In this result, you have different situations. So the easiest situation is if you have, say, a finite logical systems and three infinite dimensional physical systems. That was one example proposed in this paper.
Countably.
Sorry?
Like just countably.
Oh yeah, countably infinite. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, say for instance a rotor, right? Just a rotor with, you know, a doubly infinite ladder of levels, for instance. That's a simple example.
Do you happen to know if you take this infinite dimensional Hilbert space and break it up into irreducibles, is it just infinitely many finite dimensional representations, or are there some infinite dimensional unitary representations?
So the groups we've been looking at are compact Lie groups. So if I remember, so I'm not a group theory expert, but if I remember correctly, all representations are finite dimensional. Is that correct? So I mean, in all the cases we've been looking at, you end up having finite dimensional representations, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's the case. Yeah. Right. So we'd like to understand this transition. So this is really what we're going to be dealing with now. All right. So I first have to tell you what approximate quantum error correction is. So remember, we have this situation where you have this encoding, this noise, and the recovery going on. And we said that for error correction, we want this to be the identity map. Well, okay, if you want to do approximate quantum error correction, you just require that you can approximately recover your original state. That's basically approximate quantum error correction. You have an epsilon here that quantifies how well you can recover your state. But that's basically it, right? There's nothing special about it. And if you're really good at spotting differences, you'll notice that I've added an extra system here, the R system, which is a reference system which could encode correlations of your logical system with any additional reference system. So it turns out it's not super important conceptually, but it turns out technically to be actually pretty important. So I'll mention it here. Okay, so how do we go by understanding these approximate quantum error correcting condition? It turns out that a nice way of understanding this is going via the environment. So here, if I tell you, for instance, I erase a system, I lose a system, well, what I really mean is that the environment gets that system. Just, you know, because in quantum mechanics, we can always think of the evolution as being unitary on the larger system. So what this means is actually, on a more technical level, the environment gets what we call the complementary channel applied to the input here, to these physical systems. And there's this very nice result that's been known for a while, of course, in quantum error correction, that if you want your process here to be close to the identity, well, then the environment better get something that's close to some fixed state, right? The environment better not get any information about what you're trying to protect. And this was made, this duality was made precise in terms of the fidelity in this paper by Cedric Benny and Orshkov, which we will be using to quantify how well the approximate error correcting code behaves. So, okay, if this slide was a little charged, just keep this out of it. The environment must get very little information about the logical states. If it does get information, then necessarily you have a bad code, right? That's the punchline of this slide here.
So this is for correcting erasure errors.
That's correct, yeah. Well, it's valid more generally, but I will be focusing on erasures that are located at known locations. Yeah.
Just a quick question. Is there any dimensional dependence in the transformation between the two definitions?
No, they both have the same epsilon here. They're exactly the same epsilon. Absolutely. Good question. All right. Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons we use this version here. It's exactly the same epsilon. You don't have to worry about, you know, epsilon squares or factors coming in. Okay, so now, indeed, specifically, if we're looking at erasures at known locations, we know exactly what the environment gets. It just gets whatever you erased, right? So the way we're going to model this is that we're going to say that the environment randomly chooses one of the systems to remove, and it will get that system with some probability 1 over n, right? I have n physical systems. I choose one at random, and the environment gets this system. And to describe everything completely, because the erasures are at known locations, I'll imagine I have a register here that I call C, and this register simply stores which of the systems was erased. So just a way of saying I erased the system, and I remember which system I erased. Right. So the environment gets to know which system was erased, but also the output gets to know which system was erased. So the point is here that the environment gets access to these reduced states here on each of the physical system with probability 1 over n. Now, what's interesting about that is that, remember that I told you that the code was covariant, and that meant that the charge had to be conserved. So if I have here a charge eigenstate, so the point here is really, sorry, let me say it like this. The point here is that the environment has access to the total global charge on the physical level. Remember, I just told you before that the environment has access to the reduced state on each system with probability 1 over n. Well, we know that the charge is local on the physical systems because we want the action to be transversal. So actually, it turns out that you can find a observable on the environment that will tell you exactly what the logical charge was at the input. Because the environment, all the environment has to do is to look at like if the ith system was erased, then measure ti on row I. And, you know, calculate the expectation value, and it turns out that you'll basically just determine the logical charge that you had at the input. So remember, I told you that if you want a good approximate error correcting code, well, the environment better not learn anything about the input, about the logical information. Well, by the fact of this code being covariant, it is learning something necessarily. It's necessarily learning the global charge of your inputs. So that's bad. So that's the main idea of why our code is bad. Covariant code is bad. So for instance, to be more specific, if you have two charge eigenstates here, say two different energies, if you're looking at time evolution and the generators of the Hamiltonian, so imagine you have two different energy levels, well, the environment will be able to tell the difference here of your expectation value. All right, so now if you crank through the formalism a bit and make this quantitative, if I quantify how bad the code is, well, it turns out that you get this result. That's, so the epsilon of the code is just the parameter that tells me how bad it is, so how far my procedure of encoding noise and recovery is from the identity process. And when we have a lower bound to this, that's given by first the number of subsystems, right? One over the number of subsystems, and then the ratio of possible charge values on the logical level versus possible range of charge values on the physical level. So the delta T is just the difference between the maximum and the minimum eigenvalue of the corresponding operator. And the intuition behind this is that, all right, the environment gets to know the expectation value of this observable for the logical system, but that doesn't mean yet that they can distinguish them well on the single shot level. Right? Remember that for the approximate error correction, we had these approximate, but these are in terms of state distance measures or channel distance measures, which are, you know, one-shot distinguishability measures. So just by saying that there's a difference in expectation value, there are states, you know, you can have a situation where you have states that have different expectation values with respect to some observable, but that are actually very close in trace norm, for instance. Think of, for instance, two coherent states with where you apply a or an A dagger to them. So it's basically, you can have states that are close but that have different expectation values. But the point is that can only happen if you have a large range of possible charges in that system, right? So the punchline is that the code is necessarily a bad code, and this is how we can quantify how bad the code has to be. And the way you can get around it being a bad code is if you have either a lot of subsystems, if you spread your information over many different subsystems, so you have this one over n, or if you have a large, if each subsystem here has a huge range of possible charge values over which you can hide basically your global charge, right, and prevent the environment from being able to guess what the global charge is. All right, let's go through a couple examples. So first, there's this code that was given in this same paper by Patrick Grant, Sepper, and Sandhu, which is, imagine I want to encode a system composed of doubly infinite ladder of levels into three similar systems. So one way I can do this, one way I can do this is by this code proposed in this paper is using this type of encoding here. Well, you can check that it's covariant, right? If I have an X eigenvalue here, if you sum these guys up, you'll realize that this guy is also an eigenstate of the same eigenvalue X, but it's somehow spread over all over the place, right? And we're in infinite dimensions. This guy is actually non-normalizable, but in this limit, you see that actually you can perfectly recover, if you work out the details, you can see that you can perfectly recover the initial state from only any two of these physical systems. So that means that the epsilon of the code is basically zero, or you can do perfect error correction like this. So you can ask, how can we make this finite? How can we make a version of this where the code words are actually normalizable, make this physical? And you can do the simple thing first, which is to just apply a cutoff on your sum, right? We had this infinite sum here over all y's, and well, you can do the simple thing, which is just to cut off this sum and normalize it and see how that goes. And if you crank through the formalism and through all the technicalities, you'll see that actually this code has an epsilon that goes like the square root of the possible logical values you want to encode versus here the range of physical charges over which you're basically encoding it. So I'm, of course, hiding some constants in front, which are not that meaningful. But however, if you remember our bound and you plug in this situation, our bound actually goes like the ratio of h over m, not like the square root. So there's some leeway here, which could be either the code is not optimal or our bound is not optimal. So which is the case? It turns out that if you come up with a better code, that is, in this case, having a Gaussian envelope here normalize these code words instead of a rough cutoff, but it turns out if you use that as a code, well, then here you get a scaling of our bounds, that the scaling of the error that matches asymptotically the scaling of our bounds in terms of these ranges of charge values, right? So in this regime, if the regime of looking at larger of at large physical system dimensions, so in this regime, our bound is actually tight up to some constants and so on. So it's approximately tight. All right, now you might be interested in the other regime, which is, you remember in our bound we had this 1 over n. You might be interested in what happens if I look at many subsystems. And here I'm going to resort to a code that was introduced in this paper by Fernando, Elizabeth, and Burak, where basically you can think of it like this. Imagine a bunch of spins, and I look at their magnetization. And I'm going to look at all, I'm going to define my code space for, say, just a single qubit, where I'm going to fix two values of the total magnetization, M0 and M1, and I'm going to define the zero state as the superposition of all code words that have a given this given magnetization versus the other given magnetization. And, well, from their results, it follows that this guy is an approximate quantum error correcting code. And if you crank through the technicalities again, you can calculate this epsilon. And again, it turns out that we reach the same scaling of our bounds in terms of this 1 over n, 1 over the number of subsystems. All right. Now, I've been talking to you about the case of, you know, one erasure and local charge and so on. So this is really for illustration purposes. Our result is more general than that. If you can, you can upgrade this situation of one erasure to actually our results apply to erasure of any collection of subsystems you might be interested in. The only downside of that is you have to have a compatibility between the charge, right? So you can also upgrade the strictly local charge to, for instance, k-local charge. But the thing is, you have to have a compatibility with which systems you erase and which systems the charge acts on, which the individual terms of the charge acts on. So for instance, if you have k local charges, then you must allow k simultaneous erasures. Right? And they can be contiguous or arbitrary. Basically, you can have locality or not. I mean, it's very general. You can basically analyze any situation like that. You can assign different prior erasure probabilities if you want to say that some systems are more likely to be erased than others. Turns out that you can include as well. You can look at approximately covariant codes. That's also a situation we can analyze. And there's another situation that we've dealt with, which was relevant actually in one of the slides before that I showed. You remember I said that the bounds dependent on the range of possible charge values that the code word could take on each physical system. Well, if I have Gaussian tails, that range is actually infinite. So I have to deal with that in some way. So a simple way of dealing with that is I just cut off these tails at some place that I'm interested in, and I just pay some penalty in terms of probability. So this is a way we can deal with these distribution tails. Just cut off some tails, and then, you know, we're good. Just add some penalty, and we're good. And we can also generalize to the case where the encoding is not necessarily just an isometry, but it's a channel. All right, so the more general bound looks more like something like this. Before, we didn't have these delta and eta terms. We had a 1 over n, which was now replaced by these prior probabilities q alpha. So what does this mean, right? We have the charge. It's now the total charge over the n system is now a sum of terms. Each term might be, for instance, k local, or might have some property of, you know, affecting only a certain number of terms. And the important thing is that the systems on which each of these terms act must somehow in the noise model be allowed to be lost simultaneously. For instance, if I have a term here that acts on systems 3, 4, 5, well then somehow in my noise model I should have a probability of losing these systems 3, 4, 5 simultaneously with some probability that's not zero. And then I have some terms up here. The delta just accounts for the fact that if your encoding is not exactly covariant, it can be approximately covariant, then you just pay some price here. And again, if you have some, if you're cutting off some tails of your code words, then you also pay some price here in this at that level. All right, so that's just what our general bound looks more like. Then you can ask, everything I've told you so far, that's just U1. I just picked one generator and told you stuff about this one generator. I didn't tell you, I didn't exploit anywhere the fact that we might have several generators. And that's typically the case, for instance, if you're interested in fault tolerance, you want to do the full unit, or you might want to do universal computation, meaning the full unitary group. So what happens is that you can actually exploit this non-abelian nature of your group, say if you want to do the full UD, and you can actually exploit some group representation theory of that and come up with a much better bound for than just the ratio of dimensions. So you can actually bound this term. So remember this term we had in our bounds, the ratio of logical charges over a possible range of physical charges. You can bound this term by something that in the right parameter regimes goes like more like 1 over logarithm of the physical dimension rather than 1 over the dimension itself. So this is, I should mention, really still work in progress. And that's been mostly led by Sever, my collaborator. All right, so otherwise, I wanted to mention something else in passing, which is another criterion for how to actually certify that you have a good approximate error correcting code. And this was actually important for us because all of the epsilons I've been showing to you are really fidelity epsilons. And if you're working with a trace distance and a fidelity, then you might lose square roots and stuff like that. So we needed a bound here that was precise in terms of this. And so the two examples I showed you, the two examples that reach the scaling of our bounds, that's the code with the Gaussian tails, as well as the n physical systems, the n spins. These had to be analyzed with this criterion here, actually. So it's just a simple criterion that tells you that whenever you have a code that obeys a certain properties over how distinguishable each physical subsystem is from a constant state, well, then it tells you that the code is necessarily good. Basically, it's a criterion that we could use to certify that these codes are good. I mean, I don't necessarily want to go into the details.
This is a sufficient condition?
It is a sufficient condition, exactly. But exactly, not necessary, absolutely. You might have good codes that don't satisfy this condition, absolutely. All right, so I just wanted to mention this because it could be interesting independently. All right, so I was expecting more questions, so it's going to be a shorter talk. The points I wanted to make in this talk are, well, there are many interesting situations where it's very natural to combine symmetries and error correction. And for instance, well, it gives us an intuitive picture for why the Easton-Knill theorem holds, right? So basically, the reason why we have the Easton-Knill theorem is that covariant codes are not good codes, right? They're not good in terms of error correction for continuous symmetry. Right, so we also identified, based on this work about the error correction of reference frames, we identified two regimes in which you can actually circumvent this theorem, and that's if you go to either a large number of subsystems, or if you let each dimension of each subsystem go to some very large value, right, allowing to accommodate a large range of physical charges. And actually, in both of these regimes, our bound is tight, approximately. So, meaning that our bound is, it's approximately tight. So there are many places we can go from there. I've been talking about erasures at known locations, and that's basically the only error model we've been considering until now. But there are many other relevant error models that should be interesting to consider. For instance, displacements, phasing, phase errors, and so on. And there's another question we'd be very interested in is, well, does the fact that the code is covariant imply that you have a certain form of correlations in the subsystems involved, right? And we have a couple of ideas of how to address that question there. And then we're interested in really more specific applications to both condensed matter and to holography. We can say, for instance, for holography that, okay, we can understand now, for instance, how it's possible not to violate the Easton-Knill theorem by having symmetries that act both on the bulk and the boundary. But we don't have any, we're just really scratching the surface of what we can do here. And me not being an expert in holography, I'd really be interested in chatting with you to see where we can go with this. And that's basically what I wanted to communicate. Thanks a lot for your attention.
So can you elaborate more on this first point about other error models? Do you have some ideas how to do that? I mean, these tools that you're using are very specific to rich errors. And the connection breaks between that breaks down.
Yes, that's correct. What breaks down specifically is this form of the charge, right? This is the part that breaks down. The fact that you have here this charge that's local, that's where you use the fact that the erasure, that the error model is erasures at known locations. What our hope is that if you write, however, the part of, about the noise in the environment, like Benyon-Arishkov conditions, that's for any general noise model. It doesn't have to be erasures at known locations. But you have to work out what the complementary channel is, right? It's just, you know, instead of located erasures, you have some other complementary channel. And for instance, I've been considering phase errors for error correction of clocks, something I've been toying a bit around. So at the moment, it's more of a back of the envelope calculation I have. But basically, there is some structure there that you can exploit to see how this epsilon is necessarily bad if you want to error correct clocks. And you have an algebra of, say, clock states you want to correct against. So I've been toying with tools like that, and I believe there are some things you can say about that situation at early stages at this point. So that's the type of situation I would have in mind.
So you said that, I guess this paper right around now told that they knew that the subspaces, some subspaces of energy are good codes in these particular things. But do you know if...
Say that again.
Paper right now, you mentioned that there's certain subspaces of energy in many body systems that are good codes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So do you know if... So from this kind of result that you have, do you get some intuition of how the number of local conserved charges affects how good the code is? Like the difference between integrable and chaotic?
Oh, that's a good question. We have not thought about that. So you're saying if there are several conserved charges, then that gives an additional structure. That's a very good question. We have not thought about that, but it sounds very relevant, especially in the context of this if you have a more rich group than a U1 group you want to, you're covariant with respect to. So all of this is for U1, and for the case of UD, where do they have it? We had a way of making this bound tighter, right? Where they have this here, right? So this really exploits the fact that this group is non-abelian and that you have several generators that go in different directions that have to have satisfy some compatibility properties. So yeah, if you have some non-trivial, more rich structure than the U1 structure, then possibly you can tighten the bound even more. Yeah, that's a good question.
So, I actually considered as quantum error correcting codes. These codes by Brandau et al. Are not very good codes. They encode very few qubits, and they have low distances.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense if there's some sort of trade-off in terms of the efficiency as an error correcting code versus this epsilon? Or is it two separate things?
Right. I guess... So what we have is this bound here. I guess the best I can do at this point is try to point where the different parameters come in. So I would say that the distance of the code comes in over here when you look at these individual charges here and the range of possible charges, right? If you want to consider a code with a larger distance, then that means that we can erase more and more subsystems and have that going to the error model. So.
Does that actually affect this bound if you're just doing covariance, that's a charge, single qubit charge or qubit charge?
Yeah, that's a good question. We haven't explored it that much in that direction. Yeah. I don't think I have something clever to say.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.